Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
I'm actually just going to fashion my new car out of books.
I'm too hot and lazy to come up with a clever thing to do with books, so I'm just going to fan myself with a paper bag.
They're multifaceted. They keep you cool.
That's right. In more than one way.
Oh.
Look at me reading. I'm so hip.
Yeah, that's how he can make double entendres or whatever.
Yeah. Or I don't know what those are. Okay.
Such a liar.
I totally know what those are.
So, we're basically just going to skip listener mail because...
we're on a compressed recording timeline this week.
Yes.
So, let's just jump right into it.
We are reading The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
That's true, and I would give you the spoiler policy, but come on.
Yeah, if you didn't read this in high school, then it doesn't really matter, because the freaking one-paragraph summary on the back tells you everything that happens.
That's true.
They spend, like, three-fourths of the book, like... Who's the father of Hester's secret child? And then the summary's on the back, it says, Arthur Dimmesdale, the minister and secret father of her child. Like, okay, well.
Wait, there was adultery and a baby out of wedlock in this book?
Yeah.
I don't think I read the same book.
I just caught all the these and thous and got confused.
Turns out I read Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter by accident, so if this confusion gets a little garbled... confusion. Conversation? Ah, fuck.
Oh, I'm done. No!
I'm done!
Ben's out of here. I'm just gonna monologue for an hour about this book.
Have fun! He yells from the distance.
So, as we said, the reason we're discussing this book, at least both of us had to read it in high school. I'm not sure if everyone had to read it in high school. As we were just talking about before we started recording, it's actually kind of a difficult read for a high schooler.
That's true.
The prose is dense, and there's a lot of vocab, and so I would actually be surprised if they had you read it in the non-honors classes.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, it'd be a tough read for an undergraduate lit course, frankly.
Yeah. It's. I mean, since we did Matilda recently, and Hitchhiker's Guide, and I just breezed through those no problem.
Yep.
And I picked up this one going, oh, it's like 150 pages, I'll breeze through this one too. And then you start reading and you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like, you actually have to pay attention.
The 25-page intro felt like it was 300 pages long.
Which I totally skipped. I had to read and annotate this in high school and I was like, oh, didn't annotate the introduction. Must not be important.
Guess I'm just going to keep going.
Ben texts me like, the intro is horrible.
It's so long.
It's like, oh, whoops. Well. Oh, well, someone read it.
That's right. I'll cover it later.
More on that later. So the genre, definitely classic literature, definitely has the elements of a romantic drama, verges occasionally on melodrama, I would actually say.
It's definitely garment-rending, teeth-gnashing, emotional content yes. where nothing actually happens.
But that's, you know, classical romanticism. If a teenager were to write that today, we'd just call them emo, but Nathaniel Hawthorne did it in 1850s, so he's an author of high repute.
His prose is of slightly higher quality than the average complaining teenager.
That's really true. And actually, the scene between Hester and Arthur and Dimmesdale in the forest is very romantic.
I actually really like
following that genre.
I really liked that scene.
Yeah. In high school, that was by far my favorite part of the book. Because they're finally actually, you know, talking about stuff.
Right. But the part on the scaffold was interesting, too. Yes. More on that later.
All right, so, plot synopsis.
The power of shame compels you.
Throwing a Bible at you while you say it. And then Hester Prynne's head spins around and she vomits on you.
Yeah, I wanted to throw in something about magic and the truth will set you free, but I couldn't remember what order I had those in when I thought of it.
And honestly, the power of shame compels you is an excellent summary. I usually say those are unfair, but in this case, that's the main central theme of the book.
That's true.
So, this is all about guilt and shaming.
There's so much shame in this book that you start to feel shamed by the midpoint of the book.
Well, I just feel bad for reading those. And one of the reasons for that is because the setting of the book, Massachusetts, Ben thought Salem, I couldn't remember, so we just went with that. about 1650, I think the way the narrator describes it is some of the older folks were around during the reign of Elizabeth the First.
Yeah.
And she died right around 1600. So, you know, early 1600s to the mid 1600s.
Yeah, it was post the famous witch trials, but it wasn't late enough that they weren't still killing witches from time to time.
We actually have a character in the book who we know later gets killed for being a witch.
Though, you know, I'm going to blame that on her a little bit.
Yeah. What a stupid woman.
She is going way out of her way to let everybody know that Satan is her husband.
Yeah. Like, the narrator, I don't want to call the narrator Hawthorne, the narrator says, oh yeah, Mistress Hibbins, who was later executed for witchcraft. And I was like, oh, that sucks. Like, 3 pages later, she's like, come into the forest with me and meet the black man and write your name in blood upon his book. I'm like, you're just advertising that to everybody?
Like, you're saying this in a public place, even though you're saying it to a person under a circumstance where you're not going to be easily overheard, but come on!
Like, you know people get killed for that shit. Like, what's wrong with you? She doesn't even try to keep it a secret.
No, she doesn't.
She just approaches people like, oh, are you following Satan now too? Like, I'm pretty sure the only reason she was alive for so long was because her brother was like a governor and
right.
His political power kept her safe for longer than it should have.
I'm just imagining people going, look at that creepy old lady. She's so weird. I bet she's a witch. And, you know, us as a modern audience, of course, picturing that and going, well, that doesn't seem very fair, except you're in the middle of saying that, and she's, like, leaning out her brother's window going, Hail Satan!
Yeah. Maybe we could just read her as, like, the first troll. She's like, everyone thinks I'm a witch, so I'm just gonna, like, fuck with everyone. Tell them about, like, riding around on Satan constantly, even though I'm just, like, totally full of shit.
You know you're gonna end up getting hanged for that, right?
She's like, yeah, whatever.
First troll. The concept hadn't been refined yet.
Yeah. You religious zealots. You crazies. They're like, hey, maybe you should try trolling on the internet. You don't get killed that way. Mistress Hibbins just needed a Wiccan forum on...
That's right.
On the internet. She would have been fine.
And every once in a while, they'd go invade some Christian family moral-based website and troll their forums.
Post pentagrams on there, be like, lol. Like, I just didn't view her as that threatening.
No.
I mean, it's probably because people don't actually wander into forests and hang out with Satan, so to a modern audience, it's like, what?
I mean, I've wandered into a forest and met a dark man before, and then wrote my name in blood on something,
I don't know. You were in the stand instead of...
Oh, that's what it was.
Hit up Randall Flagg.
Who's the walking dude?
Although one of the kind of interesting things, I've read a little bit other... Wow, that was very articulate. I've read some Hawthorne besides The Scarlet Letter, a couple of his short stories, and he actually deals with sin and guilt, and actually Satanism in all the writings I've read. There's some kind of underlying threat of this kind of evil dark man. But it's always set in the context of the religious fervor, because everything I've read is always set in this puritanical time. So there's one where this guy ends up accidentally, like, stumbling across a Satanist meeting and finds out that all the ministers and, like, kind old women in his village are actually all Satan worshippers, and they, like, basically force him and his wife into it. It's pretty messed up, but...
Sounds kind of like that movie we watched a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it all has to do with, you know, here are people who act very, very good, but they're not necessarily.
Right.
And I think in The Scarlet Letter, he's not just saying, watch out for Satan. The narrator's making this commentary, or Hawthorne, the author's making this commentary of, you know, maybe the Puritans were too extreme.
You think? No.
Yeah, and actually, this is our third interesting narrator in a row. Not just a straightforward one.
Yep. He is also full of commentary on what he's seeing, and just, like, throws in Well, you could almost, actually, if you were a person who lived without any irony in your life, you could read all of his comments on the Puritans and what they do and the shame of the whole situation and think that he was being 100% serious about it. But since most of us have some irony in our lives, like, the narrator's kind of sarcastic.
The narrator makes a couple comments about people a couple hundred years, like, back when they still followed those rules,
yeah, exactly.
Kind of comments. And he is also following kind of a traditional classic literature thing. For some reason, authors loved back in the day saying, oh, I didn't write this, I found this manuscript and polished it up, or this is like notes I took on some script that I found. I don't know why that was a thing, but he does that at the end and basically says, oh, you know, I just took a bunch of commentary from people who knew people in the situation and wrote a book based off of it.
He also does that in the intro, as it turns out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you bother to read it, yes.
So we have an unreliable narrator who's commenting on the Puritan values and at the same time maybe even effing around with the situation a little bit to fit his needs.
Right. Like, here's this interesting situation I learned about. Now, here's my spin on it.
Uh-huh. And I would say the most interesting case of that happening is Dimmesdale's own Scarlet Letter.
Yeah. That was, because he makes the comment there that, well, some of the people who watched this happen say that they didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Other people say they saw it, and others yet say that they saw it and it disappeared.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, some people say they saw it, and he must have been, like, torturing himself and carving it into his own chest. And some people saw it and thought, oh, his heart is, like, burning an A onto his chest, and he doesn't have anything to do with it. And some people didn't see it at all, and it must have been, he didn't even sleep with Hester. He was just showing that he was sympathetic with all sinners in the community.
Right, this holy man can be just an abased human as well.
And then Hawthorne makes the comment, some people are determined never to think ill of others, or like ill of someone they look up to, even when evidence is staring them in the face.
He was doing the romantic literature version of the George Carlin thing. Some people don't like you to talk that way. Some people think if you talk about things, they might actually happen. Some people are fucking stupid. That's Hawthorne saying that in a more flowery way.
Yeah, in a more literary way. And so that really kind of drives across the point of the narrator saying, we don't really know what happened.
There you go. I was joking when we were drawing up our outline earlier that my favorite character might have actually been the narrator.
I mean, honestly, he's more interesting than some of the characters in the book.
Yeah, like the protagonist.
Who is the protagonist?
Well, I think you could make an argument there if you wanted to. Hester Prynne is clearly supposed to be the protagonist.
Yeah, she's the traditional protagonist. Anyone who's read The Scarlet Letter or knows anything about it, she's the person they immediately think of because she's the one who wears The Scarlet Letter around.
Right. But she does disappear for several chapters at a time.
She does.
And
for a big chunk in the middle, too.
I would say her story has a lot of shame in it, because this whole book is about shame. But, like, the inner demons and the torment and the actual character changing over the course of the book all happens in the character of Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale.
That's very true. Hester deals with this sin and the shame and actually is a... I don't know if I admire her or think she's obnoxious for not admitting who the father is. Because, like, on one level, she loves him so much she wants to keep it a secret. And on the other hand, I'd be like, fuck you. Like, you come here. I'm not going to let this be all on me.
If you love him so much, how come you aren't paying attention to the fact that him hiding it is destroying him?
Yeah. Which is totally the case. Like, physically killing him.
He feels so guilty, he dies of it.
Yeah. And Hester is... she's a doughty woman. She puts up under all that shame, she goes about her business, does what she wants, and, like, she feels bad. But, I mean, the way the narrator describes it, she puts up with it remarkably well, and she's the one who comforts and helps lead Dimmesdale to the realization and, like, can just handle all this crap all on her own.
Yeah, she's pretty tough.
Yeah.
I wish that she was a little more confident, maybe?
Yeah. And maybe a little more interesting. I mean, one of the... I thought the main interesting conflict that goes on with Hester is that she could run off, you know, go to Europe, or she could go out west and escape this town if she wanted to, and basically not have to worry about, you know, dealing with this shame anymore. And she basically self-imposes it on herself, even after the other townspeople eventually go, well, you know, whatever. It's not that bad. You've made up for it. Like, you're super helpful. People actually start saying the A stands for able instead of adultery.
There's even a little bit of talk of maybe not making her wear the A anymore.
Yeah. I mean, people really start to kind of admire her, and she just keeps pushing it upon herself.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a decision she made. I mean, I don't know why. Because if you're, if the people, because really you have the situation where she's done something that shames herself, a mortal sin, and she's living under the pressure of all this shame and guilt and open to public ridicule, except that at some point the public stops caring.
Yeah.
And if they're going to give you absolution, why wouldn't you take it?
Yeah. Or if you're like such a passionate creature, as they call her, like, why wouldn't she just run off and be like, screw you guys?
I can't explain it. Like, I think we actually don't get enough insight into that part of her
to know why.
It's like, well, she's strong and she has doubts about some things occasionally, but
she's pretty sure her child's a demon creature.
How could you think her child is a demon creature?
Pearl.
We both like Pearl a lot.
Yeah, Pearl is kind of hilarious in being like, well, she's a total brat, but like in an awesome way. And she's just a super spirited kid in like such a make your kids do exactly what you want society.
Yeah. And I think that's what it was for me. Like the fact that she was hanging around Puritans made her brattiness hilarious.
Yeah. And I liked the function she served when, like, oh, is the minister going to stand on this platform with us tomorrow midday so everyone can see him?
That's what I wanted to talk about with the scaffold scene, yes. Or the meeting in the wood, for that matter. Are you going to, you know, are we going to be a family tomorrow?
Yeah.
Well, no, then don't touch me.
Yeah, and then he kisses her anyway, and she scrubs it off.
She runs the scream and
But then the next day, when in front of everyone, when he holds his hand out and says, okay, Pearl, you know, it's time, I'm gonna admit it, she runs to him, hugs him. She's happy to do it.
Oh yeah, totally just accepting of dad once he admits to everybody.
Yep, once he's not a hypocrite.
So in a way, Pearl is more moral than everyone else in the book.
Yeah. And one of the, probably the most honest character.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of like that addition of everyone's like afraid she's some kind of like weird elf child.
Maybe that's part of the commentary too. Like, hey, the demon kid is actually the most moral of all you fuckers.
Yeah.
Eat it, Puritans.
And how she's never actually a bad kid, even though she's born out of sin and passion. I mean, as far as we know, she actually grows up and lives an awesome life.
Yeah, sounds like she's doing pretty well, like, wealthy. She's an heiress, that's what it was.
Yeah, she becomes, like, the most wealthy heiress in New England.
Yeah, because, well, first of all, because no one lived there yet. But second of all, because Roger had
Chillingworth
had all these holdings that apparently he left to her despite
being a...
That doesn't quite make sense to me, but his character didn't make sense to me.
I mean, my best guess was Chillingworth, I mean, if he legitimately did not blame Hester, which doesn't really make sense if he's has a vendetta against Dimmesdale, but, you know, if to a degree he did forgive Hester, he might have gone, well, Pearl's kind of the closest thing to a child I'm gonna have.
I guess. He...
'Cause she's the daughter of my wife.
He kind of pissed me off. I didn't like him very much. Because the first time you meet him, he's, you know, Hester's being shamed, and they have a conversation afterwards, and, okay, you can't tell anybody that I... Yo, it's your husband, just like you thought. You can't tell anybody who I am, but it's okay. I understand why you did what you did, and, like, it's all good. And then proceeds to spend the next 7 years living his entire life for a vendetta against Dimmesdale.
Yeah.
Come on, dude, like, you can't say it's cool and then be pissed off at the guy, or maybe it's one of those weird double standard sexism things where she's just this passionate creature and couldn't help herself.
Yeah, and he's...
But the man should have the moral fiber to resist.
I don't know. Also, why does it take 7 fucking years? Like, basically, it sounds like from the second that Hester has the Scarlet Letter on, Dimmesdale's failing in health and looking worse and worse every week. And I was like, how does he last 7 years? Because they're like 3 years in, he's about to die. But then 4 years later, he's even more about to die.
Why didn't... If Roger had been living with the Indians for a couple of years, like, he's not that attached to this European society, apparently. Why wouldn't he just, like, burn into town and be like, just out everybody?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Dimmesdale, the Reverend, yeah, he totally fucked my wife. Peace! And just, like, sail off to Africa or something.
She's my wife, I'm still alive, do what you want. He's like, I'm taking the kid.
Later, bitches.
All right, bye. That would have made him cooler. Basically, I mean, I think Chillingworth, instead of being, like, a character, because the book is so heavy on theme and symbol, that I think he's kind of an example of letting revenge or vengeance take over you. Because he lets it so completely consume him that even though he technically was not the one who committed the sin, he's ultimately viewed as more evil than both Hester and Dimmesdale in the end. Because of what he did, he's described as demonic a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And then once Dimmesdale kind of ruins all his plans by outing himself, he dies.
Yeah.
There's nothing left to look for.
He has no purpose remaining to him. And it had been mentioned earlier that despite being an older man, he wore his age well. Like, he was doing great when he was doing his revenge thing.
Yeah, he's a respected physician.
I mean, sometimes his eyes got this little demonic red glow, but aside from that, pretty healthy looking dude.
Yeah. So he could have, you know, done something with himself. And I think even without him around, Dimmesdale would have eaten himself up with guilt anyway. Like, he did need someone there to...
Well, he didn't know that Chillingworth was Hester's husband either.
No.
I mean, she told him. She outed Roger to Dimmesdale eventually, but that was really close to the end of everything.
Yeah, like 7 years later she did.
So... I'm not sure what his influence was, unless he was just subtly jabbing him on a regular basis.
He must have been. Like, that conversation they had where Chillingworth kept bringing up, like, holding in secrets.
Yeah.
Trying to get him to say something, and he wouldn't do it.
It must have been, like, every day with that guy.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you two friends? Doesn't that get exhausting?
Don't you actually kind of hate each other? Maybe it was just to make Dimmesdale's story more interesting?
Maybe, I guess, but...
And you kind of need that dark antagonist figure in, like, a romantic story, because you have the lead lovers, and then you need, like, the dark figure to kind of foil things.
And the dark figure consumed by revenge is such a favorite trope of all forms of fiction in every genre.
That's very true.
That's still a big thing today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never a good thing. Well, it's almost never a good thing.
Usually revenge is not a good thing.
Yeah.
In fiction and literature. I don't have any experience with it in real life, so I don't know. I've never killed anyone for killing our dad or anything. Not that our dad's been killed. So I wouldn't actually know, but...
Never had to go all Inigo Montoya on someone's
No.
ass.
Although Inigo seemed pretty happy with himself.
Yeah, his revenge was actually... portrayed as a good thing.
But if you want to take another classic literature example, a Hamlet
does
not end up very well in his quest for revenge.
Though if he had just proceeded with his revenge instead of being Hal Hamlet about it,
then maybe he would have been okay.
Maybe he would have had a happier ending.
Yeah, so Chillingworth is more of a stock figure. He's kind of a dick. You kind of go, what the shit is he doing? But, I mean, at least, because like you said, Arthur Dimmesdale could potentially be the protagonist of the story, because he does finally, like, bring about a change and make a change in himself. But overall, I thought his character was more annoying than anything else. Because he was so...
I'm so sad and tormented. Now I'm going to write an amazing sermon, apparently.
Yeah. And I liked how he'd just go up on the pulpit and be like, I'm a terrible person. And everyone would be like, oh, wow, he's so honorable. I was like, just, like, don't say I'm a bad person. Say, like, I slept with another guy's wife.
Let's hear some specifics here, buddy.
Because if you just say, I'm a sinner, too, then of course everyone's just going to be like, oh, yeah. Yeah, inspiring.
I'm pretty sure in Puritanese, every person is a horrible sinner, yeah, so.
Definitely.
No, it doesn't really, if you say that, I mean, the example it was supposed to be setting is that, oh, well, if this holy man, well-respected figure can be a horrible sinner and declare it publicly, then clearly the rest of us need to get our shit together.
Yeah, we need to fix ourselves. I also did like one of the comments where someone said, or sorry, the narrator said, that people had been confessing secrets to Dimmesdale that were probably worse than Hester's for years. You know, that she didn't even do the worst thing.
Once again, demonstrating that it's not the crime, it's whether you get caught.
Yeah. But actually, since the central plot of the entire book is this act of adultery, and actually one of the things I wanted to know is, did they have sex once, or do they do like a bunch? Because they kept saying, like, this act. And I was like, if you just had sex once and got pregnant from it, that's the lamest adultery story ever.
That is some bad luck right there.
Yeah. Like, if I was Hester and went, oh shit, I'm pregnant, I'd just be like, I'm just going to have sex with this guy until someone figures it out.
Yeah, seriously. Might as well. Until I start to show and people start to go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Your husband isn't here.
Let's bang some more.
But I think one of the things that makes this book worthwhile for reading is that the commentary is not, here's this story of sin and guilt and shame for this woman doing this horrible thing. It's Hester's actually, you know, what she did was understandable. And the author's making this commentary that the Puritans were unfair in punishing her for it.
Oh, definitely. Well, that opening chapter, you know, that first scene where she's coming out of the jail and she has to go stand on the scaffold and all the matrons who are talking to each other, each one, like, getting progressively meaner from the one before that. And really that first chapter sets the narrator's tone of, hey, these Puritans are not actually very nice.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't read the first chapter and then you just read everything after that, except maybe the last chapter... Again, the unironic mind, especially, could look at the book and go, man, he is really pro-Puritan here.
Uh-huh. But he's definitely not.
No, he's unquestionably not. I mean, these women are trying to one-up each other in ridiculousness. Yeah, being... Oh, an A that she has to wear on her dress for the rest of her life. Psh, that's not enough. They should brand it on her.
Yeah.
Brand it on her. Psh, they should kill her. And then the one woman's like, well, wouldn't it be better if people were nice to each other? And then she ends up being dead by the end of the story.
Yeah. Because, you know, the nice people never get to live to an old age because they're not mean enough.
I guess.
Which is why we're both living until we're like 100. Yeah, and he has a couple of moments that he says something, you know, well, they didn't even know if her husband was alive or dead. He could have died on his crossing across the Atlantic. That's not uncommon. She hasn't seen him in years. You know, isn't it understandable that a young woman who thinks her husband might be dead might want to take up with somebody else?
So, they really couldn't prove adultery is the thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, or at least not adultery the way that we define it.
Right.
But if it had been a scarlet F for fornicator, something about that feels like a less powerful story to me. it just, It takes on different tones.
Yeah, but it is kind of this BS thing of, well, she just supposed to wait around and be completely chaste until her husband either shows up or is proven dead. Like, should she just be celibate her entire life?
I don't know exactly how the Puritan thing works, but probably.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things the narrator's commenting on. And he also has one little jab, like, 200 years ago when people were, like, dumber than they are today. Yeah, right.
When people actually still believed in elves and magic uh-huh. and God.
uh-huh. Yeah, but that's one of the things that I like about this book, is you have this author who's writing in the 1800s, looking back at the 1600s, and he's actually kind of, he's not making a case that, you know, women who are married who have their husbands, like, in their homes should be going out and sleeping with other guys, but I think he's noteworthy for not shaming a woman for technically committing adultery.
Right.
Which yeah. is something that you wouldn't expect necessarily from an author writing in the 1800s.
Yeah, and plus there's a little bit of the, let's not put all of the shame on the woman.
Uh-huh.
Because Dimmesdale's destroying himself, mm-hmm. and until he admits that he was equally at fault, if not more so, he's suffering.
Yep. He won't be free of it. And so there's this other... And I think... I mean, I'm kind of just drawing conclusions, but this, like, horrible guilt that Dimmesdale puts upon himself is driven by the Puritanical Society.
Yeah, maybe, you know, he wouldn't be destroying himself if it were 200 years later.
Uh-huh. Maybe he wouldn't have to feel guilt if it was 200 years later. Maybe it would actually be an okay thing.
Hey, reverends in a lot of Protestant traditions are welcome to have wives and kids.
I think they did mention that he could have a wife if he wanted. Mm-hmm. But people respected him for remaining chaste.
Yes.
And, yeah, so it's this kind of this commentary on, like, religious fervor and fanaticism is driving these people into these extreme situations that they probably shouldn't even be in anyway. And then this kind of commentary on, well, if you do something bad, it's better to get it out with and, you know, deal with the consequences. Like, they should make all politicians read this book.
I wonder if they'd understand that message. Some of them would.
Hey, man, you know when you try to deny that and then people find out, like, 6 months later that you did it and then you're way more shit than you were before?
You don't even need to read the Scarlet Letter to do that. You need to have an awareness of history, and by history, I mean any one-year news cycle has at least one scandal that only happened because it was a cover-up first. Uh-huh. So, well, knock it off! Stop doing that!
Pretty much the only reason Nixon got impeached was because he tried to cover up Watergate.
The only reason Clinton got impeached is because he didn't say, yep, she blew me.
Yeah. Which is still the dumbest thing in the entire world. Yeah, maybe Clinton should be, like, holding up the Scarlet Letter, yeah. Like, guys.
There you go. He's the guy.
Here's how it goes.
So, Bill Clinton, if you're listening to this, have you read the Scarlet Letter?
Leave us a comment. Let us know how you feel about sexual repression.
What's next on the list?
Yeah, so there's not just issues of sex going on here, there's issues of religion going on here. And I think that's one of the things we were talking about kind of with that undercurrent of Mistress Hibbins and, like, the witch theme going on, of the author kind of being like, okay, guys, here's what you get when you press religion too heavily on people.
Yeah, it's that, I love the quote. I can never remember who said it, but it's that only religion can make good people do bad things.
Mm.
Which is, I don't know, maybe somewhat unfair to religion.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are definitely well-meaning people who do or say pretty bad things in the name of God or in the name of morality. Because ruining someone's life for one decision they made when they were young is pretty unfair.
Uh-huh.
You know, assuming that decision wasn't murder or something.
Well, yeah. If you just straight up stab someone, then yeah, you probably deserve to get punished for that.
Yeah, or in a more modern version of it, rather than adultery, you know, refusing to have anything to do with someone for being homosexual. You know, one thing, and you're gonna let that define the entire relationship you have with them and their entire place in society on that one thing. You know, it's also unfair.
And maybe a modern day adaptation of the Scarlet Letter would be based around someone with different sexuality.
If we were gonna remake the Scarlet Letter as a college comedy.
I can barely think of a book less suited to become a college comedy.
That's why it has to be.
It's so serious.
That's why it has to be done.
Okay. Hester would be a lesbian. Arthur Dimmesdale would have to become, like,
a woman.
Yeah. I was trying to think of, like, a woman's name that kind of sounded like Arthur. But I can't. So, yes. Dimmesdale would become a woman.
And would come from, like, a conservative background.
Uh-huh.
Probably a little self-loathing in there.
Yeah, maybe she could be, like, a Mormon or something.
Yeah, maybe something like that. And Roger would be, like, her straight-laced friend from the campus ministry who kind of knows what's going on and is jabbing her secretly all the time. I don't know where the comedy comes into this story, frankly.
Yeah, maybe it's a drama.
A dramedy.
Well, Pearl could be the comic relief.
Yeah, I don't know how you work Pearl. I don't know how you
work. I'm trying to earn my degree and juggle a baby. Although, two women sleeping together would not cause a pregnancy.
I had sex with another woman once, and now I have a 7-year-old daughter, even though I'm, like, 19.
maybe she somehow, like, Pearl could be, like, a surrogate daughter. Like a sorority daughter.
Oh, there you go.
Not like a actual daughter.
Like a wacky out there underclassman.
Yeah, exactly.
A little mischievous.
Like, running around and, like, making comments about, oh, you want to go do this? And she's like, why would I want to go do that? I don't know. It could work.
Clearly this pitch is fully developed. Somebody call Hollywood on our behalf.
I mean, honestly, nothing will ever be better than the Dracula college comedy. But
true.
But this one could still be pretty good. So anyway. So Ben already made a comment that nothing really happens in this book. But some stuff does happen in the book. So let's just talk about a couple of those big issues, aside from the scaffold scene, which we already talked about at the very beginning.
Yes. Well, there's the meeting in the woods, which has been alluded to. Hester pretty much ambushes Dimmesdale in the woods.
She's been kind of hunting for him for a couple weeks.
She's like, look, dude, we gotta talk.
It's been 7 years. Fucking serious.
That's right. Turns out they're still in love.
Oh, surprise.
Surprise. Deep passion burning within their hearts.
Which also made me go, how did they last 7 years? Like, if they're still in love with each other.
So passionate, yeah.
I mean, that's probably also a romantic trope of lovers being torn apart by circumstance. Like, in my experience, those people either find a way to be together or after a year are like, fuck it, not worth it.
Yeah.
Which is not always the case. I'm sure there's someone out there with like a grand 20-year romantic love story, but
maybe that could be a plot element in our college comedy. They can have a long distance relationship and be agonizing over that part of it.
And both of them are music majors, so they take 7 years to graduate.
That's not true. It takes longer than that.
So Hester, yeah, finds him in the forest, and we have this very lush description of the scenery around them, the grass and the trees and the brook telling its melancholy tale. And just this passionate dialogue bursting forth from them. It's very different from the rest of the book, actually, in that type of passion going on.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. It is about the only scene that is free of shame for a good chunk of it, because she actually discards the A.
Yes, and in case you hadn't been able to tell from the title of the book, The scarlet letter Hester wears is the biggest symbol in the entire world. And the act of her literally taking it off and throwing it away is symbolic of her casting off her shame.
Yeah, she casts away and literally lets her hair down.
Yes. She does both of those things. Like, if you can think of, like, a more obvious way to show this. She feels the lightning of her heart immediately.
Yes.
And she pins it back on, immediately feels it burning her again, so.
The weight and the pain.
Yeah, it's very overt. She's not being very subtle there.
And then Pearl, who is a symbol of the symbol.
Yes.
Is she meta?
The living symbol of the scarlet letter. She actually won't talk to her mom unless she has it pinned together.
Yeah, I know. That was kind of a dick move.
That was pretty rude.
That was the one time where I was like, Pearl, come on.
No, and Hester actually said out loud to her, when she said, Mom, or Mother, you must put the scarlet letter back on, and she does, and then she's like, okay, and she hugs her mom, and she kisses the scarlet letter, and Hester's like, seriously, Pearl? Like, that's really rude. You know I hate this thing.
You're hurting me, baby.
Yeah. Why would you do that?
Because I'm a little elvish demon child.
Yeah. But this is the scene where you finally get the big decision. You have a big plot point.
Yep.
Hester and Dimmesdale are going to run away together, take Pearl with them in like 3 days' time. Dimmesdale actually feels way better, although it does open his heart up to other sin.
Yes.
Which is kind of an interesting moment.
On his way home, like, every three steps, he's tempted to do something horrible.
It's really funny, actually.
It's kind of like that first chapter where each one is just, like, progressively more over the top than the last
one. Yeah, he's like, he runs into this old woman who he normally says, like, Bible verses to make her feel better, and this time he couldn't remember a Bible verse, and then he, like, managed to come up with something.
Yeah, he, like, mumbles something in her ear, and apparently it makes her happy, yeah. But he doesn't know it. He doesn't even know what he's saying.
Yeah. Then he runs into a young maiden, and all the virgins in the congregation totally want to bang him real hard. And he's so afraid he'll say something rude to her, he just ignores her. And then she cries because she thinks that
she did something wrong.
And then he runs into Mistress Hibbins, who's all like, let's go worship Satan together.
Who's all like, I'm a witch, everybody.
And he's like, whatever. And then, my favorite, he sees the Puritan children together and wants to teach them naughty words.
Yeah. He wants to go over there and be like, hey kids, have you ever heard the word fuck before?
I just love that image. Like someone in the 1630s, 50s being like, oh my god, I can't teach these kids the word fuck. So funny. Like, what a horrible sin.
What a horrible person I am. I'm going to go write the most amazing sermon in the history of sermons.
Yeah, that we don't get to read a single word of.
Man, it's Hawthorne being self-aware.
Yeah, like, I can't do that, so we'll just pretend.
This is not the best sermon in the world. This is just a tribute.
He's using tenacious to open him out. Yeah, and that is really where the book takes off. They decide to run away together. Dimmesdale goes and writes this amazing sermon. There's a big procession the next day. They're supposed to run away together, but Hester finds out from the boat captain that Chillingworth found out and is going to come on the boat with them, and she's trying to think, like, holy shit, how are we going to get out of this situation? And then Dimmesdale finishes the sermon and is just like, all right, guys, it's time.
Yep.
Gonna face the music.
I'm just gonna hop up on, walk down to this scaffold here, and I have some things to say. And Roger's like, no!
Yeah. Chillingworth is like, this is the only way you could have defeated me!
he's shriveling up in front of their eyes. And Dimmesdale is, like, almost developing a halo.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. I'm the other adulterer. I'm a horrible sinner.
And then he dies of the shame and the redemption. It's kind of implied that him finally doing that's going to get him to heaven.
Yeah.
Because he owned up to his shit. But it's a little unclear.
Yeah, it could kind of fit. It ties in a little bit to that. Something from the intro again.
Mm.
So, What's next?
Well, I mean, those are the really big plot points. I guess, actually, one of the other things I did want to mention is Pearl's been this kind of elfish, bratty child running around laughing. People are constantly like, are her feet actually touching the ground? And then at the end, when Dimmesdale finally admits everything and dies, Pearl starts crying, and there's a note there that says, like, she was finally able to connect with human society and emotions.
Yeah.
Because this tragedy happened to her. And she kind of finally went, okay, and, like, kind of became a person after that, I guess.
Yeah, she's always just a little bit above everything before that.
Uh-huh.
Like, didn't really register all the way. So, I guess we'll finally... Or I will finally talk about...
I didn't read the Custom House.
The Custom House introduction just a little bit. It is... Well, it's probably 5 times longer than any individual chapter.
Yeah.
Because
it's like 30 pages long.
There's so much of it. And it feels even longer than it is. There were some tidbits in there. It's kind of a... I kind of wanted to quote mine it just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the first things he talks about, well, okay, he babbles forever about how he came to the Custom House, but whatever.
Yeah.
One of the first things of substance he says is that he had relatives and ancestors who were Puritan ministers. And as much as says they were bad people who did bad things and they're burning in hell right now. Like, he didn't use those words, but that's what he took, like, 2 pages to say.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things Hawthorne is known for is writing about colonial America, so that was obviously a thing for him.
So he was throwing down on the anti-Puritan thing right away! And then he talks about the characters that were in this custom house with him, and... That stuff was actually kind of okay. Some of that was a little bit funny. Like, there were all these old guys that mm-hmm. he was working with, and some of them were, like, one of them had been a general, and now he was, you know, in retirement, essentially, working at the Custom House, mm-hmm. and, you know, describing how he was, or this older gentleman who, I wish I could remember the quote for him, but he was not particularly bright, and not particularly competent. And the only thing that the guy could really wrap his brain around was, what's for dinner? But, like, everybody loved him, because, you know, like, it was the way he described the character is this glorious celebration of just a really nice old dude who had nothing else going for him other than being a really nice old dude.
Fair enough.
And then the last chunk of it is a more in-depth description of how he came across the manuscripts and, you know, from the former guy in charge of the Custom House. Oh, and there's a little political commentary in there, too. That was the other thing. He was actually talking about partisan politics. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And how, oh, well, there's a new president who's not in my party, so... No, we all knew that I was as good as going to the guillotine and then talking about walking around headless for a couple weeks. And
that's actually kind of interesting because he wrote the book in 1850,
mm-hmm.
so it was pre-Civil War drama, like, driving politics apart, I bet.
That's... Yeah, and he was talking Whigs versus Democrats, uh-huh. actually. So Republicans not even in the mix yet. But, yeah, I mean, there was some interest. There were probably... 3 or 4 paragraphs in there that I went, oh, that's really interesting. And then
it's like
interminable description of everything in painstaking detail.
Well,
which is kind of his writing style.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, actually.
The prose is florid, bordering on tedious.
That's why we were just saying it'd be difficult for a high schooler to read. I mean, I remember it being kind of tough, but not insanely tough. You have to sit down and read this in the quiet. You have to put your attention on it. Like, I was trying to read it while my brother was watching baseball in the background, and it was impossible. And the way he just crafts his sentences and sticks the vocabulary in there, you have to just drill into that.
And... Oh, and he never says in a full in a sentence what he can say in a page.
Oh, yeah. Like, the one that really stood out to me was when Dimmesdale was thinking about the confession he wanted to make, and it was, I who have done this, and who have done this, and who have done this. I who have done this, and this, and this, and this, and this. I who have done this, and this, and this, and this, am a sinner. I was like, oh my god, just say I am a sinner.
Just what are you? Just spit it out.
Like, people know you've done all that stuff.
So there was a great line I came across at one point in the book.
It is fantastic.
Yes, those of you who follow our Twitter feed, which, you know, in fairness, to those of you who don't, we only update like twice a week. I was reading along, and they are passing some of the Puritan children, and what they say is... Behold, verily, there is a woman of the scarlet letter, and a truth, and of a truth, moreover, there is the likeness of the scarlet letter, Pearl, running along by her side. Come, therefore, and let us fling mud at them. It's like, what?
From the mouths of babes.
From the mouths of babes. That's they sound just like children.
Totally what kids
say. It's totally what children say. Puritan children don't sound like that.
No.
No children sound like that.
It's the thing you were talking about, throwing in jokes from characters off screen, describing exactly what's happening. Yes. Nobody does that. That quote reminded me of that. Like, let's spell out exactly what's happening here. She is the one of the Scarlet Letter. Her daughter is a representation of the Scarlet Letter. Now we have... It's like you would just... You just like, whisper to your friends, like, let's throw mud at them.
It's like they knew future generations of students would have to read it. So he was cueing them in. He's like, yo, symbol, guys!
Yeah.
Put this in your paper!
Just so you know, Pearl's wearing red, guys.
That's right.
It's totally significant.
Here's what's up here.
And I mean, that's a problem throughout the entire book, is these people talk so old-fashioned and boring.
Oh, man, the dialogue is stilted even for a classic.
It doesn't feel real. Well, I mean, Shakespeare was written in the 1590s, and his dialogue sounds more natural than the Scarlet Letter.
And he's not even remotely trying to make it sound natural.
No.
Maybe Hawthorne wasn't either, but...
I don't know.
He had to have been thinking at least a little bit to himself. Yeah, this is what people talked like in olden times.
Yeah.
Giggle.
That's kind of the impression that I get, honestly.
A verily, moreover, thou thy the leasehold.
Oh, tons of these and thys. I feel like that sometimes when I'm writing historical fiction, I write a sentence and I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, I don't know if people ever talked like that.
I'm so screwed.
Because even if you listen to, you know, a letter that Queen Elizabeth I wrote, she just sounds like a person writing a letter.
Yeah.
I mean, she's smarter than all of us because she's quoting, you know, shit in Latin naturally. But she's still, like, straightforward. So that's definitely something that you put upon to sound grander.
So we're going to organize that old-timey language.
And I'd say that's definitely the biggest hurdle in the book. If you're interested in reading it, is the language is the biggest thing you have to get past to get the story.
And to a degree, also the thing you're reading for.
Yeah.
Because it is, as you said earlier, an excellent representation of kind of a romantic style.
Uh-huh.
He's describing things in such detail and describing emotions a lot.
Very grand emotions with exclamation points.
Which brings us to context relevance.
Yeah, so I get why people read this in the classroom. Everyone in my class actually hated it. I was the only person who didn't hate it.
That's not surprising. High school kids who don't hate this are probably few and far between.
Yeah. I kind of liked that. And everyone was like, so boring. And my teacher's like, how did you like this book? Not like she hated it, but just, you know.
Right.
You're the only one. And I think the problem is that it's probably not taught the most interesting way it could be taught. Because there is, as we talked about for a while, this issue of sexual and religious oppression, and is adultery, like, right or wrong, and all this stuff in there that could generate class discussion forever. I mean, people have opinions on sexual
in a college feelings. Class, you would definitely talk about the sexual element in this book.
In a high school class?
Yeah, one of the things that we talked about before we started recording was that in a public high school setting, as a teacher in a lot of places, it's actually kind of dangerous to talk about that kind of stuff. You could lose your job.
Uh-huh.
For daring to suggest that America is sexually repressed and then ironically getting fired over talking about sexual repression.
Yeah, someone would go home and say, my teacher talked about sex today, and then they would get fired.
And the parents would flip out.
But I think that's really what makes the book interesting, and I mean, that's what Hawthorne is commenting on.
Oh, absolutely.
And Ben and I were saying that it's a good book for high schoolers because the symbols and the themes are so obvious. Like, no one's getting confused by the subtle message tucked away in this book.
Yeah, this book would be a really easy paper topic.
Uh-huh. And I remember getting paper topics on this book and just going, oh my god, like, you know, describe the differences between light and dark. Oh, Hester can't walk in the sunshine until she throws off the scarlet letter.
Right.
It's like a 10-page paper. You don't even have to try.
It's high school. It's like a 3-page paper.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, you know.
Even in an honors class, it's a 5-page paper. Yeah,
without even trying, you're like, oh, I just wrote a paper.
Exactly. I just wrote a paper in the last 5 minutes of our conversation. We just wrote a paper for someone.
Yeah, like, by the way.
Transcribe part of this podcast and turn it in.
Don't actually do that, by the way. It's plagiarism.
That is academic dishonesty.
And you have to cite us if you use our podcast.
And if your teacher is one of the 25 or so people that listen to this, then you will get an F.
Yeah. questions for the book.
Why didn't they just run the hell away to begin with?
Yeah. Why does Hester wear that shit for so long?
Yeah.
And then my other question, did they do it one or more times?
Yeah, I really want to know.
Is Dimmesdale a good lover? I don't really want to know, because he's kind of gross.
He's a little...
I think Hester would be probably cat in the sex.
Picturing her, she's described as being a very attractive woman.
Yes.
So, did you like it?
I think it's interesting. I think you do have to take the time and effort to read it. So, don't read it if you don't want to sit in a quiet room and really focus on it.
Yeah. I also found it interesting. I actually kind of liked it, even though most of the things I've had to say about it have been slanted probably against it in this podcast. I'm not sure why I liked it. I think it was mostly because every chapter had a good quote in it.
It has a couple of compelling moments, and the narrator sneaks in just enough that it's less of just a boring, straightforward tale of, you know, people who did a sin.
Right.
It's definitely not that.
Right.
So, anything else to say about the book?
Nope.
Okay.
I have this to say about the book. If you have something to say about the book, then you can contact us one of the following ways. A professional segue. You can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can hit us on Twitter, novelideaspod. We might even check it.
Yeah.
More than twice this week.
Yeah. You can find us on iTunes by typing in Novel Ideas, clicking on the podcast link.
Yep, and you can subscribe to us there, and if you listen to us through iTunes, feel free to leave a review
or
a comment.
We actually have enough ratings now to have an average rating.
Yeah!
We have an average rating of 4.
Hey, that's not bad.
Oh, yeah.
That's at least twice as many stars as I would have hoped for. what you reading right now?
I'm reading a book called Elizabeth and Mary, Rivals, Cousins, Queens, by Jane Dunn, and it's actually an exploration of Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, and their two roles as queens and reigning monarchs of their time, which was unusual, and then their relationship with each other and how it was colored by the fact that they actually never met.
Huh.
So, pretty interesting. I'm digging it.
All right. Well, I am reading, actually, another classic to a certain degree. I actually was just about to start it when Gab showed up to record, but it is called An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and it's by Ambrose Bierce, who is better known, if he's known at all among modern non-literary types, as the author of The Devil's Dictionary. Which, by the way, is pretty hilarious and about as darkly cynical as anything ever written. So I strongly suggest, you know, just Google it and read the first 6 quotes that come up. I think you'll be sold.
So, for next week, we are reading a science fiction classic.
Ah, Dr. Isaac Asimov's Foundation. The original Foundation.
Uh-huh. Just not the trilogy, just the book Foundation.
Yeah, though we could probably handle the trilogy in a week if we wanted to. But that's okay. Foundation is plenty.
And, yeah.
Dang, is that it?
Yeah.
Let's get out of here.
Okay.
That's it. We'll see you next time.
Bye.